This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Averett Phillips, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Ethel Morgan Smith about her new book, Path to Grace, Reimagining the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. Ethel Morgan Smith, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. So Dr. Smith, I wonder if you could just start the interview just by telling us a bit about yourself.
My name is Ethel Morgan Smith. I live in Birmingham, Alabama. I taught for 24 years at West Virginia University, and I've taught at other places. Virginia Tech was the beginning of my academic career. I've taught at Randolph College. I've taught in Europe. I had a Fulbright scholar to Germany, which is one of my books too. I have three books now. So yes. So, and I'm working on, if you're a writer, you're always working on something. You put it aside and you go back and say, oh, I think I got this better now. So yes, I'm always working on something.
Awesome. Well, how did you come to this particular project?
Oh, you know how you go through a phase and a lot of people start to die of a certain age. And I remember well, it was a lot of civil rights icons were dying. And I go, oh my God, you know, every time, Julian Bonds and the others. And then I thought, well, what can I do? And I started spinning my idea around and I had this long list of 100 people, and it just evolved. Because one thing I learned, that you have to have some access to the people to do it. Some of the people died, some of them died. One of the things I do know is from my first book, I try to interview the oldest people first because they typically die first. So anyway, and it just got down to these few people. So when I finished the interview, then I wrote it in prose. And then there was something missing. I had to figure out a way to connect these essays. And so what I did, I said, oh, I'm a child of the civil rights movement. I could talk about my life in between. So that's how it came about. Yes.
Wonderful. And so this book sort of extends sort of our conventional understandings of the civil rights movement. So what made you decide to sort of make that sort of expansion by talking about sort of other people that were involved in this movement as well?
Well, because the idea of so many icons were dying, I started thinking about how many people that we don't know who had a voice, who were warriors in the civil rights movement. And I just started talking to different people. And as I talked, I got ideas. So that's how it got started. I think you asked me another question. So then I decided I need a connection with the people I had interviewed. So, and I started thinking about my own life. You know, I'm a child of the civil rights movement. And I remember one publisher said to me that he had a problem because I wasn't part of the civil rights movement. I didn't do any marches. So that's when I go, well, there were so many other things to do. There was so much behind the scenes were going on. And anyway, and it's like, well, that's okay. I don't want them anymore. So, but it worked. Once I made the connection with some flashes of my early life until my adult life, and it worked well for me. So, yes.
So, how did you go about finding these people that you interviewed?
Well, some of them I knew already or had known a long time ago. The first people in the book are Dr. Sandra Ford is a childhood friend whom I hadn't seen in 40 years. And then when I moved to Birmingham, we reconnected and I got involved with their project and their work. Mr. John Canty, who worked for Presidents, I didn't know him. He was the first interview I did that I never met him. Someone introduced us, and that person was a historian. But he was just your lovely person, so lovely. So, as a matter of fact, very honest. And he still also had a sense of humor. So, yes.
And that definitely comes through the chapter. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
What were these interviews that you conducted like?
What were the interviews that I didn't hear the last
Oh,
part?
sorry. What were the interviews? What were these interviews actually like with these individuals?
Well, okay, they were different. Like I said, I was a little nervous with Mr. Canty because I didn't know him and had never met him. When I interviewed Constance Curry, for an example, I knew her. And that's hard in a different kind of way. She was a public figure, and I had known her. I think I started the chapter with, I hardly remember a time when I didn't know Constance Curry. And because that's the way that it was. Let me see. Oh, there's a woman named Andrea Lee who lives in Turin, Italy. And we became friends when there was Skype. Remember Skype?
Yes.
Because she was a writer for The New Yorker. And teaching African American literature, I was always looking for middle class Black people to read about, expose the students to, because it's easy for students to think both Black, white, other, always that. Black people were always poor. So trying to introduce, so that's how I started reading her. And so she was a great person to interview with. Yes.
And do you have a favorite story from your interviews that you could share with us?
Well, I think that I interviewed Susan Perry Cole, who was one of Shirley Chisholm's legislative aides. And I had known her 40 years ago and that kind of thing. So we did this reconnection. She lives in North Carolina, Rocky Mount. So she was recalling back what it was like. She said, oh God, I thought it was so chaotic and so unhealthy. People were smoking and, you know, this kind of thing. So, but Mrs. C, as Miss Chisholm was referred to, was very proper and prim because she comes from the Caribbean and her early school was British. So the Congress, she was the first African American woman, Congresswoman, decided that they would put her in her place. So they put her on the Agricultural Committee, knowing that she represented Brooklyn. But history has a long reach and we don't think about this. For an example, she took it. And that's why we in this country have food stamps, and that's why we have the WIC program. Isn't that marvelous? That she, you know, she, hey. And she became friends with a Senator Buchanan from Alabama. And I think if I recall right, Sue said that he said, well, I don't think we knew who we were dealing with, you know. So I love that story that she didn't complain, didn't whine. She just took it and did something else with it. Yeah. So, but there are so many stories. When I go back now and try to think of them, Mr. Canty joined. He's joined the ancestors. Mrs. Moore, the woman from West Virginia, she passed away. But they were all in their 90s, and I was so happy to get their voices and hear their stories, you know, and how pleased they were that someone was interviewing them. Yes.
And so you talked a little bit about the connective tissue that you sort of created in this book, right? And so in between sort of the larger chapters of this work, you have these short sort of vignettes of your upbringing. So what purpose do these stories play in the organization of this book?
Well, what they do, it serves as a memoir to my life, because I think the first one is Book Notes, and it ends with my mother dying, and I'm with Nikki Giovanni. Her mother has died, so I grow up through these interviews and that kind of thing. So that's the purpose that it serves. Yes.
Awesome. So, chapter one, you focus on your friend, as you said, Dr. Sandra Ford, and her husband, Henry Michael Ford. So, who are they, and what led them to the path that they chose?
Well, it's an interesting path that they chose, and very challenging. And they've been doing it for about 20 years now. So if I re I think I wrote this, it's in the book. I hope I remember the story correctly. They were dating, and one day in the gym, Henry said to Sandra, "Do you know anyone who could kill a member of the Klan for me?" And she said, "You know, this is the school teacher's daughter, this is the doctor. No, we couldn't live that kind of life." So they decided to turn their life over to God, as if I'm quoting them correctly. So they both went to theology school and to see what would happen with their lives. So this organization was born as a result of that. Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit about the organization and the work that they
Yes,
do?
the Spirit of Luke. What they do, they have a medical mobile unit, and they use volunteers. For an example, a lot of medical students here at UAB who are interested in serving, volunteering, and that kind of thing. And every place they go into the Black Belt, the poorest areas in Alabama, every first weekend of the month. And they serve. Things have had to change because of COVID, of course. But they bring food, they bring vaccinations. Some of the people have not seen a doctor in 10 years, 15 years. They've added a pharmacy to the program. They've added food. They've added a clothes bank. And it has just over 20 years has grown, and what they do for these people. And the people are so thankful and so appreciative and so humble. And it's just amazing to see them. And to hear them sing and to do what they do.
And in chapter two, you focus on the very historical and important life of John Canty. I loved this chapter so much. As I was telling you, I smiled more than I have read a book in quite some time, especially with this chapter. So why is Mr. Canty important? And why do you think his life has sort of escaped this historical examination up to this point?
Well, I think that number one, I was surprised that no one had interviewed him. That was a surprise. And he's a very gracious Southern gentleman. So he wouldn't have gone after anything like that, but he would just live his life. You know, he had these stories to tell about he was started with President Johnson. And he went through until the Reagans. And after that, he retired. He worked in the White House for 18 years. And they really wanted him, as you know. And so he went over and to be on detail. You know, if he doesn't like it, he could come back, kind of thing. And he ended up staying there. But he was very smart and he was very political. He didn't talk much, he listened more. And he never would say anything negative about anybody, you know, but it was funny. What you could do is make him laugh, you know, that was funny. And he said all these memories had come back to him that he thought long ago were tucked away. Yes, but he had a very nice laugh about him, and he had been part of a team who did some renovations for their church, so he wanted me to see that, so we went over to see his church. And yes. So the church ladies considered him, let me see, how shall I say this? They were always leaving pies and casseroles at his door. And they would put notes on it. Mary would want us to take care of you. So he said, Mary would want you to leave me alone, you know? So he was cool. He had that kind of wit about him. Yes.
And so I understand that the Southern Gentleman portion. Why do you think other people haven't or didn't reach out to Mr. Canty while he was alive?
Well, I just think that's the way that's the way it is in our society. I think that Black history has been so whitewashed, and we have to go back and find it. And I was lucky enough to find some of these people who, you know, who had a voice, actually, who participated, not in the traditional way, but all of them that I interviewed gave money. You know, the civil rights movement was a big part of their lives. Now, Mr. Canty said not a whole lot changed in real life. He said one of the things that he honored Johnson for was appointing Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court. He said that was a big deal. And another big deal is when he passed the poverty program. Yeah. So he said that made some changes. He said, but other than that, it wasn't as much change as the nation, as the news, the journalists said it was. But I think ultimately it became, because when I say history has a long reach, we never know what one little effort will end up being, you know. I think that, Isabel Wilkerson does a great job in her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, when she talks about how Berry Gordy, all those singers got together. They got together because their parents moved north. If they had stayed in Alabama, Arkansas, you know, it never would have been. So that's what I mean when I say history has a long reach, and we're not always aware of it. So what I wanted to do was to tell personal stories about the civil rights movement. Like I said, about people who are overlooked. I think the New York Times now has a obituary column called Overlooked. And it's made up of a lot of African-American people who made great contributions to this country, but at the time they were overlooked. And I think that's what we need to do. Because we don't think of, a lot of people don't think of what their parents or their grandparents went to, you know, kind of thing. Because Black people through enslavement were taught to be silent. You could die if you weren't. So there's these voices of silence that we don't hear about, but they come from somewhere, and that's where they come from. And yeah.
Okay.
But eventually someone will talk. Eventually someone will get excited about your project and talk. Yes.
And Constance Curry is a friend of yours, someone that you say, obviously, in that first line of her chapter that you can't remember a time when you didn't know her. And her life intersected with giants of sort of the civil rights era, these sort of names that we all
Absolutely.
Know.
Well, she was such a role model for me, because when she went to law school, I thought she was 40. And when I went to graduate school, I was 37. And I remember thinking, well, surely I could go to graduate school. Connie went when she was 40. So when I was interviewing her, she goes, I was 50. That's how she spelled. I was 50, you know. Well, she and Julian Bond have been best pals for a long time. Since I think she was 25 and he was 19 when they first met. And she said, we just sat around and told dirty jokes all the time. You know, she's but she was so serious. And, you know, when she talked about being in Mississippi, and the white women were less of a threat, so which means they weren't going to shoot them down, how scared they were. I just had this utmost appreciation for what she did. It was marvelous. I don't know if I could have done it, but we never know what we can and cannot do until it's upon us. But I just loved her. Even I have never, like I said, I've known Connie where she's passed away, but I knew her, oh, you know, 40 years, maybe longer. Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about the work that she did?
Well, Connie did biographies a lot, because in Mississippi, of course, people called upon her. So her first book is a book called Civil Rights. So when the law, the land, said that Black students can go to this school or that school, so she wrote about the Carter family, They had 12 children, and they enrolled them in the white school, what we call. And so Connie and some of the other women went down there to make the transition smooth. And those kids finished school, and I think most of them, some moved away, but they maybe 8 or 9 of them went to Ole Miss. So Civil Rights was her first book, and she had and there's a film production about it. Then she did a biography of Aaron Henry, who was a pharmacist, and he was going to go to college, but he went into the army instead. And she said he called her, and he said, "Plenty have asked to write about me. I don't want anybody to do it but you." And then she did another one. It's the white women who were in the civil rights movement and what some of them went through. We don't think of that. Some of them got shut out of their families. You know, they lost, you know, we don't think about their loss. So I think it's just important to do that, that everybody comes to the table because everybody has a story to tell. Yeah. So that's what I try to do in my writing. Yes.
And I think you succeed in that for sure. So the last chapter of the book focuses on your interview with Nikki Giovanni. Can you take us through your sort of relationship with Nikki Giovanni and the topics that your interview with her touched upon?
Oh, I've known Nikki for so long. Let's see. So I think I told you I went to graduate school at Hollins, was 37. And one day I had moved from Atlanta and my son was had gone to college in, at Wesleyan in Connecticut. So one day I'm just unpacking and listening to NPR and I hear this voice and I go, "That was a familiar voice." So I listen. So in the end, the reporter said, "And we'd like to thank Professor Nikki Giovanni." And I go, "Oh my God, she's a poet and she teaches at Virginia Tech." So I go, "Oh my God, that's 40 miles from here." So I did something as simple as I wrote her a letter. She did something as simple as she wrote me back. And then I got a job and we developed the Black Studies program. That's one of the strongest programs they have now. And so we have been friends ever since. In fact, yesterday, day before yesterday, she called and goes, "We're stuck. We're in Nashville. We're trying to get a plane to Birmingham. At least you'll have us." You know, it was so funny. So I go, "Why are you out? You should be at home." But anyway, so that's how the relationship started, and we still write letters. We do this thing. We both collect African American stamps. So with Nikki, a lot of things become a competition. So, and I always beat her. I won't tell you how I beat her. I have a trick. And she goes, "I don't know how you do it. You just moved to Birmingham." Oh, anyway. So we do that together. We love tennis. We love cooking. You know, it just works. It just works. Yes.
And what did you both talk about in your interview?
Oh, when I interviewed her?
Yeah.
Well, it's like we'll start talking about one thing and we'll get off subject and we have to get back on subject. And it's not until I get the interview transcribed and read it and go, I have to go back a second time and ask, you know what I mean? The more specific you are, because Nikki will start, she'll go back something that doesn't have any relationship to it. But that's the joy of doing an interview with her. You don't know where it's going to take you. Yes. And it always takes you somewhere fabulous. Yes.
And so what sort of audience did you imagine for this work?
I see it as a general kind of audience. I didn't, it could work in a creative writing class. It could work in a high school class. It's a very traditional kind of story. It's just that I use a non-traditional structure to tell this story in. But anyway, when you write and you have to be daring and try new things, you know, it's like, "Well, this should work. I got it. Do I need to put vignette?" And it's like, no. So anyway, so I'm so happy that it worked. Yeah.
So I'm curious, what is your writing process like?
Well, I've been writing all my life, oh, as far as I can remember. So I write when I can. And if you've taught at a university, it's demanding. It's hard to carve out. Even with tenure, it's still hard. So I write when I can. And what I do is I have a writing journal. So when I think of something, I jot it down, not a personal journal, but just my writing journal. And sometimes I go through it for ideas that I wrote down about something. I get up early in the morning, not by choice, because I have a dog who gets me up early in the morning. And usually I start working. It's too early to call people. And you look up and go, I need to make this phone call. And you look up, it's like, oh, it's 6:15, or it's 7 o'clock. So anyway, but that helps me. I'm better in the morning than I am as the day goes by. And sometimes it depends on what I'm working on. If I'm just reading something and see, trying to figure out if something works or not, it tends to take a little bit more time. Probably I have jotted down two or three ideas with that piece that I'm having a problem with. And then you go back to it and see if it works, or do you need to start all over again? Yeah. Writing is rewriting. That's what I tell my students. That's the more you rewrite it, the better it gets. Yes.
As someone that has a dog that gets up early, I understand the getting up early and just trying to be productive. So I get it.
Well, right. And nobody's up and it's quiet. You know what I mean? So it works out well. Yes. And gets you in a routine. I like routines. Yes.
And what do you want readers to take away from your book?
I want readers to take away that I'm sure there are stories in their families that I want them to rethink their family stories or talk more to the elder family members to get these stories. And when they're gone, they're gone. It is so valuable. But I think that too is part of the civil rights movement, preserving our history and not just dismissing it. Like sometimes when I can't sleep, I watch the little cute kids on TikTok. And so they have this is supposed to be comedy, except I don't find it funny. So you'll have teenagers saying to their granddad, "Granddad, were you a slave?" And people laugh. But there's pain in that for me, that you don't know when slavery was. It wasn't with your grandparents. And it's very important that you know that. It's the big, it's the best of us now. You know what I mean? And the least you can do as an inheritor, as an heir, is to understand it, the time period and that kind of thing. So, yeah, that rattles me a bit.
Understandable. Well, Dr. Smith, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you for being so generous with your time as well. So I'll ask one final question. You've already sort of talked about it a little bit, but maybe you can expand a little bit more. What are you working on now? What's this project that you're sort of tinkering with?
So, okay, so I've never talked about it before because I keep hearing you shouldn't talk about what you're writing. But anyway, I'm working on a collection of essays, and white people will be the center of the stories. White people that I knew or thought I knew when I was growing up. So that's a little bit different too. That all the center of the, we used to have a doctor who used to come and do house calls on Thursdays in our neighborhood. That kind of thing. So that's what I've decided to do is once again play with some structure a little bit.
And what are some of the challenges that you're finding in that?
Oh, I'm not finding any challenges.
Oh,
I
no.
haven't gotten that. No. Another thing I'm working on is one of the people in the path is Ann Cole Love, who is getting some attention now, but she's very important. I'd like to see, I don't know if I can do it, a biography of her, but she was born in a town that I am from, and I knew her, one of my classmates' father was her first cousin. So we always knew her, but I would like to see how that would go. I've already written one chapter about her, and I started writing a play about her. So we'll see what happens.
Awesome. That sounds amazing. Well, Dr. Ethel Morgan Smith, again, I want to thank you for coming onto the show. I want to thank you for the work again. As I said to you, and as I think I've said already, but I will repeat it. I thoroughly enjoyed this book. I, like I said, smiled more often than I have read a book in quite some time. And
Well,
I'd
thank
like to
you.
encourage people to go out and buy this book.
And Valentine's Day is coming up.
It is indeed. There you go. That's a great present for it. Again,
Exactly.
thank you for being on the show. I really enjoyed the interview and again, really enjoyed the book, and take care.
Thank you. Thank you for everything. Bye-bye.